you. Our input that we had received from the Fairbanks community was that it came as a last-minute surprise to the community, and the community was totally unaware of it. Any of the conversations over the past year about Fort Wainwright that has come out of Washington has primarily indicated that the post was not going to be cut down, although the local government officials here, I think Mayor Rice, for one, when he was in office, indicated that he expected to cut the post. But we had the general indication that the post was going to be maintained for military purposes. So Alyeska, all of a sudden, emerging on the scene as a major lessee on Fort Wainwright, frankly came as a surprise to us.
You've indicated that perhaps there may be a bigger problem than just this one incident of Alyeska leasing facilities on North Post.
Oh yes, Pat, I think that it's going to be absolutely essential that local government, the state government, and the oil industry work together. In other words, it seems so often that these things are done in a big cloak of secrecy, then sprung on either state government or the community, and we're all expected to bow down. I, for one, I'm not elected by the stockholders of Alyeska. My first interest is this community. If the community feels that this is a compatible thing, they feel that their tax base is protected, and that Alyeska is going to share their burden, then I'm for the thing, because obviously one of my jobs is to support the interest of the stockholders of the state of Alaska, not Alyeska. So I took rather strong exception to the method in which it handled it. It appears to be kind of been a tempest in a teapot. It appears that the majority of the community looks favorably upon the thing. Okay, if that's what they want, that's a position that the governor and I would support. But I still think that we've got to, in some of these instances, instead of getting communities bouncing off the wall like this, lay the cards on the table and discuss them ahead of time. And I think that this is one of the things that the oil industry needs to shape up their public relations department sometimes. This type of incidents occurred before in the state.
This is a political year. What are your political plans this year?
Well, I very much enjoyed serving as lieutenant governor. We feel that this particular, the number two job in the state, can play a vital role beyond what input that we can give to the governor. We feel that getting out and getting around the various parts of the state and finding out just what people are thinking, providing this input to the administration, can be a valuable one. So it's been an exciting year for us, and our present plans are to file for lieutenant governor again in 1974, and with Bill Egan running for governor. Of course, the governor will do his own announcements, but that's the way I hope it'll be.
Your birthday party's tomorrow. When's your actual birthday?
Well, you know, both the governor and I felt that, you know, having a birthday party where a lot of people could participate is an ideal way of raising funds. So my birthday is during the month of Aquarius, which is January 21st to February 22nd. Actually, my birthday, Pat, is on January 27th.
How old are you now?
I'm 53 and holding.
Do you ever get, this time of year, itching to get involved with the gold panners again?
Oh, I think I've always been involved in them. It's a fantastic program. I'm tremendously proud when I see the Seavers and the other kids that have gone on. I see the spirit that is created not only in the Fairbanks community, in the Anchorage community. So I guess I am involved. Today I was over at Lathrop and I was visiting with the people over there, and every now and then they were talking about baseball, and they were talking about me running around the streets in my shorts winning bets. And I'm still very much involved with the young people, and that's, so I guess I'm still involved with the Gold Panthers one way or the other. Certainly, and they were a highlight in my life.
Boucher's birthday party will be at the Traveler's Inn beginning at 9 o'clock tomorrow night. And at 6:45 tonight, Boucher will be the guest on the KFRB talk show Beeline.
Quoted you as criticizing your colleague in the Senate, Ted Stevens, for helping to draft that emergency energy legislation. Is that so?
He served on the committee that did draft the legislation, but I didn't criticize him. I think it's up to the people of Alaska to make their own judgments as to the actions and what we're doing. I merely stated that this emergency legislation would cost Alaskans $10 billion and would also bring about an increase or an inflation in prices of gasoline and energy around the country. What this legislation will do, by rolling back the price to $5.25, it will cause people to drill and explore for oil in other countries. Then they'll turn around and sell it to us at $10 or $15, where we deny and discriminate against Americans. This discrimination also goes for Alaskans.
Well, Senator Stevens apparently read that Associated Press report, and he responded, He's quoted as saying that you, Senator Gravel, are thinking more like an Arab oil sheik and should realize Alaskan oil is American oil and that to significantly increase oil prices would only lead to more inflation.
But we're not increasing the oil prices. The world price of oil is $10. Now, what we can do is by denying Americans the right to sell oil at a normal price, what everybody else is selling it at, is we'll just cause these people to invest abroad in oil and then sell it back to us, not at $10, because by then it'll be more scarce. It'll be $15 as to what Americans will be paying for it. Not to talk about the fact that we'll put ourselves in a position of exporting large quantities of dollars, which would jeopardize our whole economic system. So we're not going to stop inflation by government passing a law saying it should be stopped. You stop inflation by permitting the production of the product so that there's abundance. And of course, the policy that he's talking about is a policy of scarcity, which increases price and causes inflation.
Senator Gravel, there are two sides to most questions, and on the questions of interest to us in Fairbanks, you and Senator Stevens seem to find different sides. The other is PET 4. You want it opened, he doesn't. Is there any middle ground in this?
Well, there's no middle ground. You do nothing, which is the middle ground is his. But here again is a classic situation. We don't have enough oil in the United States. The Arabs have us embargoed, so we have to cut back and suffer. When we're sitting on billions and billions of barrels of oil in Petroleum Reserve Number 4. Now, they say they need this for defense. That's poppycock. The Navy is getting appropriated monies right now to build a nuclear Navy, not a Navy fueled by oil. So why should they sit on this reserve rather than put this reserve to the total national inventory, which would have an effect in protecting Americans and causing Americans not to suffer from this crisis?
Senator Stevens says he believes opening PET 4 would depress the price of leasing of state lands, private lands, native lands, and that this oil should be sought first.
Well, two things happen there. You can't have your cake and eat it too. He's saying that he's for the emergency energy bill because it will decrease the price to the American consumer. Now he's saying that, well, we don't want to put up PET 4's oil because we know it's there, because that will decrease the amount of money that's put up on bonus bids. So we're caught. So he's willing to have scarcity and let foreigners sell us high-priced oil rather than letting that oil come from the United States. In point of fact, I have not advocated that PET 4 be opened up on a bonus basis. We know there's oil there. What we ought to do is just turn around and lease it to oil companies on a royalty basis or negotiated basis so that we citizens can get more of the action, since they don't have to speculate on getting the oil. If that's the case, which is what I hope it will be, and I'll have legislation to back that up, then there would be no competitive problem to the natives or to the state issuing or putting up its land for bonus bid.
And Senator Gravel, you and Senator Stevens have been on opposite sides of the issue at Fort Wainwright on the leasing of the North Post. How do you feel about that right now?
Well, I took the position that what Alyeska should do is be assured that the business community, the private business community, is protected. These assurances have been granted by Alyeska to the community, and the community is satisfied. So I have no opposition. I was merely concerned about safeguarding the local business community in question. But when we talk about the position that I've taken with respect to Fort Wainwright and what Senator Stevens has taken, it's interesting that it was I that was trying to get the post in the hands of local government or the borough or the city. If, had we been successful and had it not been sabotaged in the House, we would now see this money from Alyeska go not to the Department of Army, but would go to the Fairbanks City or to the Fairbanks Borough. And that's very tragic in my mind that they're not going to get this money.
Your reference is to the U.S. House Military Subcommittee on Military Affairs, where they reversed the action on the
right.
Surplusing.
We had it squared away in the Senate, but it was killed in the House.
Finally, Senator, you arrived late this afternoon by rather unconventional means, I understand, on the SST Concord. What was it like?
It was just like flying in a 707, except for the takeoff, and we just took off just straight up. And it was
the nose on that airplane, does it turn down?
It turns down for landing, so that they can, landing and takeoff, so that the pilot has visibility. And then once they get ready to accelerate speeds, the nose just closes up, and it's just like a sharp
a hydraulic
dagger.
Action on the
yes.
nose there. Yeah. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Otherwise, on stage at the Alaskan Civic Center Theater at 8:15. Sonny and I'll be splitting for there after the show. We have a good show for you tonight. In the second part at 7:25, our guest will be Senator Mike Gravel, who arrived in town late this afternoon on the Concord. Arriving in town for a birthday bash tomorrow night, our Lieutenant Governor and former Mayor, Red Ballinger. Welcome to our show, Red.
Nice. Good to be back again with you and Sonny.
You say that you've been making the show often. This is true. You were here with Bill Wally on October 9th. We were talking about impact and the energy crisis. One thing that we touched on, and it's even more imminent now than it was then, you're about to certify the Camp Lemieux petitions, aren't you?
Exceeded the 9,000 some odd that was needed, so there's no doubt that there were sufficient signatures on the petition to place it on the ballot in either the primary or the general election. Of course, there's one thing to remember here. In an initiative petition which is created by the people, the legislature has an opportunity to respond to that particular thing. So I think that I think you may well see the Move the Capitol not only be an issue at the polls, but possibly affect this legislative session before it's through. Because
I don't understand that. How does the legislature get into this thing?
Well, basically, you have two forms of a petition. One is an initiative petition by the people, and one of the requirements in this is that it have sufficient signatures in order to go on the ballot in that particular year. It has sufficient signatures to be presented to the legislature before the legislature goes into session. Well, this was the case. In fact, there was a hurried-up effort. Now, basically, it is a law suggested by the people to be implemented, so it can be subject to amendment or be presented. The legislature can bring forth something similar on it.
Well, that Frank Harris has the necessary number of signatures, it will be on the ballot.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. It will be on the ballot in one form or another.
The legislature could put it on the ballot?
Oh, yes, right. It would be possible that the legislature could come forth with an amendment to the Constitution.
Would it appear twice? Would we have two?
The subject could be, or a modified or amended approach could. It's possible.
Will it be in the August primary or the November general?
Well, that largely depends upon when the legislature convenes. If the legislative session lasts more than 120 days, why it would go on the general session. Less than 120 days, it would go on the primary. This is, I don't have the exact number of days following the convening, or rather the closing of the legislative session. The requirement period that would have to decide whether it would go on the primary or on the general election, but that simply is decided by the length of the legislative session itself.
So if it's a short session and is acted on by the legislature, then the people of Juneau will be happy, because that would put it on the August primary ballot where they want it. If it has to be on a ballot, they want it then, because fewer voters
will. Yes, right. That's been expressed by a number of people already on the thing.
What do you sense in the state now? Don't you feel that the state is of a mood to vote in favor of a capital move?
I don't know. That'd be just pure conjecture on my part, and I've tried to, since I have the responsibility of carrying either the legislature or the people's wishes forth up to the primary or the general election. I've tried to avoid generalities in dealing with this issue. I do feel, as I indicated in my last meeting here, that to some parts of the state, this is a matter of convenience. To southeastern Alaska, it's a matter of life and death. And we must bear in mind that there are many things that are going to affect Fairbanks and other parts of Alaska that are going to have to be ruled on by people from southeastern Alaska. And if this divisive issue arises before the close of the legislature in all of its glory, as it has in the past, I see irreparable harm being done to the state. I see legislation that would be badly needed being set aside because of the emotionalism of this Move the Capital issue. You can already see, since we have announced to the general public there were sufficient signatures, that there's a genuine and deep resentment and concern throughout the southeastern Alaska communities. I think that in some instances there are overreaction, they're lashing out at other parts of Alaska. But to me, this distresses me very much. I'm always a let's put the state together and not pull it apart. I would be...
You were instrumental it's been about 8 years now. 7 years since you were mayor? It seems hard to believe, but I guess so.
Well, I was 66. I was elected in October 66, yeah.
8 years now, and at that time, you were the first person to really start to break down the walls of provincialism, mm-hmm. particularly between Fairbanks and Anchorage.
Yeah.
And when you say that this will be divisive, it surely will. It'll build a wall around Southeastern that will take forever to break down.
Oh, wow, you might as well just, they'll forever remember it. And we live in the southeastern community now. We have seen the reaction, the fear in the businessmen's eyes. It's just about like, let's say, for example, and this would be a lesser degree, I'm talking about the Capitol. Let's say, for example, that somebody put a petition together with 10,000 signatures to move the University of Alaska to a place, somewhere west of a certain degree of longitude and no more than 30 miles closer to the city of Anchorage. What would be your response in this community?
And the simple fact is that the university, to the degree it must move, does move by attrition, and the same is true of the state capital.
Wait.
It has moved by attrition.
Correct. Now, there, you've hit it. See, there are state capital facilities here. I mean, fishing game, many facilities have been expanded. In Anchorage, a tremendous amount of those facilities are expanded. Now, I think that the capital is a state of mind, Service to the people, I think that it has been expanded by all administrations, both Republican and Democrat. So my thought is to improve by every method communications between the capital. I think that some of the dollars that we're investing in deciding whether or not we're going to move the capital could be devoted to developing the finest satellite communication system any place in the world, where we could not only move news across it, we could utilize it to provide improved medical facilities throughout this state, to improve educational facilities. There's just too darn much to be done in this state, and so much challenge in the next 10 years that the state's going to have to face up as a united Alaska to come along with this thing. So I'm less concerned about the issue itself. I do recognize that it's going to create a tremendous amount of divisiveness in the state. I mean, not unlike the North and the South during the Civil War. And in
not
this
unlike
case,
at all.
No. As I said, it's a matter of life and death to southeastern Alaska as of today.
I believe the Juneau Assembly is coming up to meet with our Assembly for an all... What is it, Sonny? Do you recall?
What do you mean, what is it?
It's an all-day session together?
Yes. A joint meeting of the two assemblies.
Do you recall when it is?
It's in March.
So
the 11th or something like that.
Junoites are going to be up and talking why they don't want a capital move. Our guest is our Lieutenant Governor, H.A. Red Boucher. He has a birthday party coming off tomorrow night at 9 o'clock at the Traveler's Inn. He and Heidi will be there, and of course, all are urged to join them. And we'll be back right after this.
You're listening.
I don't know when your birthday is. It's January 27th.
My birthday's in the month of Aquarius. Bill Egan's is in October, and he celebrated his from Ketchikan to Nome throughout October, and a good Republican friend of mine says, Boucher, does every birthday party you have make you a year older? I sure hope so. But yes, January 27th is the right day.
There's a rumor that you might not run again and that you might step into industry. You said today you do intend to run again.
Absolutely, Larry. When we were here in Fairbanks, we had job opportunities. And recently we have had job offers. I think this happens to people in public life. Quite probably ours was because of the trip that we had done in other parts of the United States, and basically the offer was it was in excess of $50,000, and our primary efforts will be to directed to putting a image program together for an energy producing company, both within and without the state. But these things are short-lived. I don't think that I really have the right to use taxpayers' money to position myself for a $50,000 or $60,000 job. That sounds kind of benevolent, but beyond that, you know, I really like what I'm doing. I think it's a tremendous job, and I do intend to run for lieutenant governor again this year. I've learned a lot. There's a lot more to learn, so I kind of enjoy this people business.
Somebody asked me today, and I'd really forgotten. Will you file again, and do you appear in the August primary on the list of lieutenant governor candidates on the Democratic side?
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, the incumbent probably wouldn't be challenged. You'd probably appear there alone on the Democratic side.
All right. Well, in the primary, both the governor and myself run on our own, you know. So once again, the people have an opportunity to choose the two running mates. I don't know whether I will be opposed or not. I think it's kind of like my thoughts about sports. You get out there and you give it your best shot, and you head straight down the track and try and cross the line before anybody else. So I'm not worried about who is or who isn't going to run against.
Well, it appears evident at this point that Governor Egan will run again, and so we'll probably see in the August primary your name is the only one for lieutenant governor on the Democratic side, and his is the only one for governor.
I wouldn't be too sure of that. You know, you can't tell. Well, let's see. Already, I think somebody's filed against the governor. I don't know who it was, but
it didn't make much of a splash.
Well, it didn't. I'll tell you. You decide you're going to run against Bill Egan, that's about like standing out in the middle of a...
I have a strong hunch as of this past weekend that Wally Hickel has made the decision, and that his decision indeed is to challenge Egan for the governor's mansion.
Well, I'd kind of like that. Have him come on in. You know, there's a lot of room in the ring, and I'll be there. I hope I would have the honor of being next to Bill. And we'll give him a fit, because after all, when we came aboard 4 years ago, I mean, there was no native land claim settled, and there was no pipeline. So we can talk about what we did, not what we're going to do.
That was exciting a couple of years ago. You and Governor Egan knocked off Keith Miller and Bob Ward. I have that hunch about Hickel.
Mm-hmm.
And I also will... You and Governor Egan then team in as a single vote in the November election.
Uh-huh.
And the Republican nominee.
Yes. That's provided, hey, look, you know, I've got a race to win, and I'm not assuming, you know, that on my side of it that there wouldn't be somebody run.
Well, you wouldn't assume that. And I don't, occasionally a politician will not run and think the people somehow owe him something.
Yeah,
it happened in a couple of state senate races, for example.
Yeah,
and those people lose. You always run because you have you're serving the people. A big question I want to get into, of course, and our guest is our Lieutenant Governor Red Boucher, former mayor of Fairbanks. You got very exercised about Fort Wainwright this past week.
You done what I did. Like somebody said, well, what'd you get
Please,
excited about?
Mr. Boucher, it's my license, you know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, Sonny.
Really, it's all right.
All right, okay. But our first reaction was that it was unfavorable to the Fairbanks community. Now, bear in mind, nobody's going to sell me a bill of goods on this, because I was mayor of this city from 67 to 70. And we, at that particular time, tried to negotiate with the United States Army to annex the base. You'll recall that in 68, I brought before the council a request to approach the Army on annexing it to the city of Fairbanks in case at some future date the base were to close down, that the city and or the borough, whichever the case may be, would have first option on that property. I mean, there are some facilities out there, such as school facilities, which I believe couldn't be used by this community. And if the base shuts down, the community is the first that should benefit by it. Now, I am not opposed to Alyeska or anybody else moving on there, as long as it's in the best interest of the Fairbanks community. And by the best interest of the Fairbanks community, I mean that whoever's going out there is not going to get special dispensation on taxes and not have to share his part of the community load as a good neighbor. So the way the entire thing was unveiled is just... It just upset some people in the community, and obviously the governor and I are not elected by the stockholders of Alyeska. You know, I've been out and boosted and pushed for the pipeline, so nobody can say I'm anti-oil. My interest is in the community and the people of the state of Alaska, and if all interest in those are protected, and if it's a long-range benefit to the Fairbanks community, then so be it. But this much I've got to say, the method in which it's handled, was handled, and the public relations as presented by both the Department of the Army and the oil industry leaves a lot to be desired. We're going to be in partnership here for quite a few decades in developing the resources of this state, and I think it's about time that they stop being so doggone secretive about some of their operations and kind of lay it on the top of the table with both the state and local government, and we won't have this things like this where we're all bouncing off the wall. I make no apologies for it at all.
Public relations has been your fort from the time you were mayor, and you said that Ed Patton of Alyeska called you when you got upset about this. Did you mention his PR to him? Because
yes, Mr. Patton called me on the subject, and obviously when you say anything bad about somebody, they're very upset, and I reminded him of the time that I took a heck of a lot of heat in certain parts of the United States because of the oil industry so-called arrogance and indifference, so certainly I couldn't be, you know, be accused of being somebody who has been needling the industry all along. But I did, in fact, in several instances, I expressed this to some of their executives that I thought that their public relations approach, and in many instances, been about the level of an eighth grader. You know, I think that for the resources that industry has, it's going to have to work close with the community. Big four-color brochures don't get it. I mean, if they will just have somebody sitting down and establishing dialogue with your local city councils, your local press, or what have you. I think you, as a member of the media, and certainly the other people that I know, seemingly have to keep digging for everything that you get. Nobody will communicate with anybody. You know, everything is a big secret, and what you do is you read about it in some trade journal, like the Oil and Gas Journal. There's the information there for everybody to read that you people in Alaska, in the media, are trying to get out of them. And I think there is one heck of a long ways to go in improving the dialogue between industry and the private sector and the government sector.
You're right. I may be naive in what I'm about to say, but I believe that the men in Alyeska, in its hierarchy, who in fact know what's going on, don't actually apprise their PR arm of what's going on, so that we work through the PR arm and we can't get it because they don't really have it.
Well, sometimes that's why I wouldn't take a job, to be quite frank, with some energy company. I wasn't going to be anybody's local token PR person until they've decided that they don't need me. They've gone around and hired darn good media people, and oftentimes they don't know what the president's doing. They make their decision at their executive levels in their New York executive offices or Los Angeles executive office and don't plug the other people in. They say, well, really, what difference does it make? After all, we're bringing all this business to Fairbanks. What difference does it make to the community? Well, it makes a heck of a lot of difference. They're taking Alaskan resources out of this state, and they should pay a fair price for participating in it. They're over in the Middle East, and the Arabs are twisting them by the tail, and they're bowing in every which direction to them. Well, I think in this state that we better start off with common courtesy to each other. And the thing that really fired my rockets off was when one of the Alyeska PR people said, well, we're not in the business of, I think he said, creating goodwill or something like that. Well, we're in the business of building a pipeline. Well, hey, look, I've got a message for them. I mean, this is not just their oil. A portion of it belongs to the people of this state, and what happens to that affects everybody in the state.
This was a quote attributed to Bob Miller, their top PR man in Anchorage, and I can't confirm whether he said or did not say it. However, it was surely inappropriate because it was like, boy, I got permit in hand, fellow, we're going to run it.
Hey, that's just it. And one thing I would say to anybody that's listening now, look, this is an Alaska resource. We've traveled all over the nation. The industry and America needs this resource. It was clearly pointed out by Scoot Jackson, who, to my way of thinking, has been one guy who's really been on top of this thing nationally, that if industry didn't build that pipeline, it was of such importance that the federal government would build it. So don't let the industry break these boogeymen out at you every time there's a gut issue and say, hey, if you don't do this, we're going to pack up and move to Anchorage. Fairbanks, Alaska is going to grow as the industrial and supply center for this pipeline, and Anchorage will grow as the administrative center. And I don't think you have to necessarily knuckle under to them every single time there's a controversial issue. Maybe it's good to lay it on top of the table. They're going to have to be here and be good neighbors and be a part of the community.
And aside, I'd like to see Senator Henry Jackson be a presidential candidate. Would you?
You betcha I would. I like Scoop Jackson. I think he's done a fine job. I think in a few areas, Alaska's concerned more recently that he hasn't taken a look at the total picture, but you're not going to be in agreement with everybody all down the line. I think, by and large, he understands what the national concerns and that.
I made two decisions recently that rubbed the wrong way, but your point's well taken. It's not always going to take a stance that's...
That's right. Beware of the politician that, agrees with everybody all the time anyhow, and everybody's a nice guy, you know.
Back to Alyeska, there is this rumor. And if it's not true, there will be others similar to this that will be, and I think this is a big problem to focus on now. It's this. Several of the automobile dealers in town, in Fairbanks here, have told us that Alyeska has awarded a contract to Alaska Sales and Service in Anchorage for 116 vehicles, and they only learned about it after the award went to Alaska Sales and Service in Anchorage for the 116 vehicles.
When did this happen?
Well, apparently just recently we got word today.
Yeah, well, that's another one of those last-minute things. Now, see, if I was some of the local businessmen, I would bow my neck on that, you know.
Jim Thompson, for example, is big enough to make a bid on something like
that. That's
right. This. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't hear about it earlier, why not?
Well, you know what amazes me, Larry? Is, let's say, all of the for-rent space in this community. Now, this community is still struggling back from a 67, 68, 69 flood, for those who may not remember it. And there's millions of dollars in SBA money still going out of this community. And many people have bet on the come or bet on the future, and I don't think that that's bad. If the industry came in here and said, all right, what is all of your available space within the community? What are your leading business communities? What services can you supply? They could buy everything out of their change purse on what this project is going to cost. You know, they'll spend massive amounts of dollars in other areas and a little bit of simple grassroots public relation. Now, there's one company that I'm going to say right here has done that from the beginning, and that's Atlantic Richfield. Mo Benson and them, when they came to this community and I was mayor, hey, they shook hands and they've always kept the word. They've helped with the ballpark out there. They put a location out here at the end of the field, and Johnny Russo, to the best of my knowledge, buys a great percentage of his stuff within the community. So Atlantic Richfield, as a petroleum company throughout the state, probably shares the finest public relations. And I want to qualify that. They've always been square shooters and upfront. But some of the others are too busy playing their worldwide games, and Alaska is just an insignificant something to them. And I resent this type of
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think in Atlantic Richfield, it comes right from the chief executive, Robert Anderson.
Hey, look, I called, when I heard this thing, I picked up the phone and called E.M. Benson, Mo Benson, who used to be right here on the North Slope. I called him in Los Angeles and I said, Mo, what the H is going on, you know? He said, I haven't heard a doggone thing about it. Now, Benson is directly below Thornton Bradshaw, who is being earmarked for chairman of the board, and he knew nothing about the Alyeska deal. So it's still going to be pretty interesting to me. Just as Mike Gravel pointed out, he was working to have these facilities turned over to the community. When I was mayor, we were talking about it, but at that time, no, don't touch it because we've got great military plans. Now all of a sudden, we find the military plans are Alyeska pipeline. Well, somewhere along the line, something happened, and it'll be very interesting to me to see how this community looks at it 6 to 8 months from now. And I think you ought to stay right on top of it. And I'm not trying to be an antagonist, just Fairbanks' interest first, and then the petroleum industry's second, and I don't see any reason why a good partnership relationship like that that can't work out.
Our guest is our Lieutenant Governor H.A. Red Boucher. He's in town with his wife Heidi, and they'll be honored at a birthday party at 9 o'clock tomorrow night at the Travelers Inn. A final thought or two here. You followed Fairbanks as closely as anyone possibly can, and you're apprised a little bit more than most of us about what's going to happen. What is going to happen in the next couple of months here?
Well, I think that not just the next couple of months, but in the next decade, Fairbanks is going to become one of the major support communities for the petroleum industry.
Like in Calgary?
I would say more like an Edmonton. Calgary tends to be like an Anchorage. That's the administration and the banking center. I think that you're going to find that Fairbanks is going to be more the supply center, you know, where equipment and what have you is going to be moved out of. There will be some administrative offices here, and I think that we can't lose sight of the fact that in addition to this pipeline, what it will also foster is more exploration. And you have areas northeast of Fairbanks, up in the Kendick, for example, that may well contain petroleum discoveries that are significant and result in a whole new perspective to the community. So I think there is an exciting future. There's one thing that I would like to see the community do. And I brought it up again today when I was talking to the journalism class. A number of years back, we suggested that the Dunbar community, which is on the rail site, be annexed to the borough as what we might call an industrial site, where if you found an excessive burden in this community in industrial development, that Dunbar is right on the spur of the railroad, you would have what you
where
call...
Where is Dunbar?
Well, it's just on the turn as you begin to come into Fairbanks, as the Alaska Railroad comes north. It's really just a little a wayside station, but I believe there is land that which under the Borough Act you could annex this to the North Star Borough and give thought, especially with the problems that you've had as far as pollution and the over-industrialization of the valley area, and give thought to making a satellite industrial area. These things are not impossible to do, and I think that just to kind of let Fairbanks grow like Topsy is going to be a disservice to the community, and you can run into some problems.
I've never heard the Dunbar suggestion before.
Well, I did before the council. I think I suggested the same time that we annex Fort Wainwright, and at the same time that I suggested that we explore the potential for geothermal power in thermal hot springs. And as I recall, I think one of the reporters said that I was like Don Quixote batting at windmills. Well, I noticed geothermal power has become popular since our discussion of that in 66 and 67. And Dunbar, for those listening, Dr. Wood will remember my presenting this to him and to the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation.
It's the last whistle stop before
just
Fairbanks.
About, right. Uh-huh.
Outside the borough boundary.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's within the borough boundary now. And I talked to John Carlson. We still can bring some more land into the borough. In fact, at that particular time, I don't know whether you call it, I also suggested that we annex the North Slope. And, you know, sometimes a few of these far-out ideas seem to be far out, but so often, I know in Alaska, we have been going from spot development to spot development. I think now's the time for us to begin to think big, to move into the dimensions that match this state. My biggest concern is that we won't think big enough. Alaska's up front. America needs Alaska now like it's never needed it before. In the next 10 years, the name Alaska is going to be almost synonymous with the life, America's lifeline to its future. And I think we ought to stand tall. We don't have to run around to the oil industry or anybody else with our hats in our hands. Man, today has arrived.
Happy birthday. Thank you very much for coming up.
Happy birthday, Red.
Hey, and I got to tell you something. And for those of you out here that haven't seen, I saw a picture of Larry and Sonny's son, Casey. And boy, Sonny, I'm going to say it, the people should see it. It looks like Larry Carpenter with a wig on. That kid has got his father's
poor
grin in your eyes, right? He is going to be something else.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much for coming up, Red, and very sincerely, happy birthday.
Okay, thank you very much, Larry. You too. Sonny?
Thank you, Ed.
Okay.
Coming up next, U.S. Senator Mike Gravel. Sonny?
Hello there, nice independent lumber man. You see, I wouldn't like to buy...
Well, I'm sure we have it, sir. Now, this is independent lumber, the complete builder supply store. You know, we've got paint. I have tile grout. There are light bulbs over there. Boat wax, paint brushes, sure. Also, carriage bolts, electric fuses, soldering guns, stove polish, hatchets. Look at that mosquito repellent. And there are hinges. Bisqueen, I have that. We have wire brushes, chain, cabinet handles, paint remover, wood screws, even heat-resistant paints, cleaning pads, electronic ovens, cabinets.
Well, you see what I would be...
Door locks, certainly, yes. Pegboard hooks, faucet aerators, Formica countertops, staplers, automatic washers, sheetrock tools, there's scotch tape, drapery rods, sunset books are there, too. Also, we have some chainsaws, some nails, do-it-yourself books, carpeting, stovepipe, snow shovels for that time of the year, they're double-bitted axes, and, you know, literally thousands of other items as well. Now, exactly what was it you wanted?
Well, I actually needed 2x4, about 4 feet long.
Oh,
no.
Independent Lumber, the place with everything, including the kitchen sink.
You're listening to your own University Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra rehearsing Brahms' Academic Festival Overture for concerts in Delta Junction and Fairbanks on the 23rd and 24th of February. Then, the symphony will accompany celebrated percussionist Terry Hulick in Mio's Concerto for Percussion and Orchestra and pianist Jean Morbihan in Beethoven's Emperor Concerto. The orchestra will also perform Cole Grass as Quiet As and the Brahms Overture that you'll hear now. This is the sound of your University Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra, now in its 16th season. Don't miss these concerts featuring over 50 of the finest musicians from the Fairbanks community and the University of Alaska. That's the Delta Junction School on Saturday, February 23, and at the University's Fine Arts Center on Sunday, February 24. Both concerts start at 8 p.m. Tickets for the Fairbanks concert are available at Wood Center and Borealis Bookstore.
When I was a boy on my father's farm, we had about everything a farm could have. We raised cows, horses, chickens, and pigs. Always had several dogs and at least a dozen cats around. My father treated those animals like they were members of the family. What I remember most was the way he treated the land. It was as if it, too, was a living thing. He didn't abuse it. He rotated crops to give the land a rest. He kept the steep land in pasture and timber because, he said, if he plowed it up, the hard rains would just wash the topsoil away. I didn't realize it, but my father and his neighbors were doing something to improve the environment. Only they didn't call it the environment then. They called it home. Same's true today. You might find it hard to believe, but more than 2 million farmers are Soil Conservation District cooperators. They have the same respect and feeling for the land my father did.
This message from the Soil Conservation Service, U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Presented as a public service by KFRB.
Listening to Beeline. Our Beeline number is 452-2468, 452-2468. Larry?
Thank you, Sonny. We're privileged to have as our guest again U.S. Senator Mike Gravel. Welcome to our show.
Larry, a pleasure being here. Following Red Boucher is quite an honor.
Yes, it was a fast first half. I suspect it'll be a fast second half.
With Red and his understanding of the issues, it's always a fast first half. He's probably the best lieutenant governor we've ever had.
You flew in on the Concorde. Say a word about that. This hasn't been on radio yet.
Well, the flight is very much like a 707. You know, you've got a small tubular cabin, And so from that point of view, you have a very claustrophobic feeling. It's not like 747s or DC-10s. It was very posh inside. Most of the chairs were, I think, genuine leather. Two-thirds of the aircraft was all instrumentation because of the cold weather tests that they're running. There was no difference in the flying other than it's difficult when you're sitting in the middle of the aircraft to see anything because the wing is so big, and one. And two, when you take off, it's just like shooting an arrow in the air. It's just like a short field takeoff, and it just goes straight up. And we were about 97% the speed of sound. We didn't break the speed of sound.
Did you feel much noise inside?
No, it just looked like a 707.
Critics have said three things about the SST, the Anglo-French project with the Concorde: that it's too noisy, that it's uneconomical, that it's to operate, it's too expensive to build. How do you feel? Will the United States ever take a different position toward the SST? Will we remove a ban saying that you can't move it supersonic speeds across the U.S. territory?
Yeah, there's no question we will. I had, as you don't recall, worked very hard to try and get the continued American SST. And in fact, I went to Bristol, England back in 1970-71 to see the SST firsthand at that point in time so that I could be briefed by the British and the French and obviously handle myself better on the floor of the Senate with this information. We unfortunately made a bad decision in my regard. We're still building the SST, that's the B-1, but we're building it under military auspices rather than commercial auspices, and I would have liked to have seen the commercial endeavor go forward. They were only borrowing the money, and they would have repaid the money. As it was now, they don't have to repay a thing, and the money just went down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
It would have an impact. Now, as far as the Concorde itself, no question, it's not economic. It's not a great economic aircraft. It is noisier. That can be taken care of as we move into other generations of engines. And they had a lot of trouble with this engine. In fact, I think Rolls-Royce almost went broke over it. The Concorde is particularly designed for long hauls, Pacific Rim, like let's say Anchorage to Australia, from here to Europe. Fairbanks to Tokyo. It's an ideal aircraft for Alaska because we are the international crossroads, and so this aircraft would improve long distance travel, the speed of long distance travel. They told me that they flew from Toulouse, France to Keflavik in 2 hours and something, and then from Keflavik to Fairbanks in 3 hours and something. So that's a 5-hour trip from Toulouse, France to Fairbanks, a little over 5 hours, which that's not pushing it either, I'll tell you, because...
At the controls when it landed here, when it came in from Iceland, was Andrei Turka, who's a vice president of the company Aerospatiale. The French company, he's vice president for project testing.
Mm-hmm.
And they arrived an hour early. Although I wouldn't say, I can just picture them, you know, up over, they can go as fast as they want to anywhere but in the United States, I guess, and I can just see them pulling on the throttle and arriving early any place they want to arrive early. Sonny?
I have already three questions from callers, Larry.
Okay, we'd better get into some of the things. Go ahead.
One caller said that he had was left with the impression that you had voted against the SST.
No, in fact, I voted for the SST and was one of the major sponsors of it, fighters for it, in the United States Senate.
Another question, Larry?
Sure.
This was called in earlier by someone who said they wouldn't be next to a phone when you came on. The caller was discussing selling wheat to Arab countries and asked if you believe we should increase the cost of wheat to these companies comparable to the Arab increase in oil on a percentage basis.
In 1973, the cost of oil in some Arab countries, not all Arab countries, quadrupled. And now it's about three times. Now the world price of oil is about twice what it was at the beginning of 73, but at one time last year it was three times and then four times. Now it's about twice. It's selling about a little over $10 a barrel. The cost of wheat in the world market has trebled
1973. So we have already raised the price of wheat. In fact, President Nixon was bragging very much that this is what helped keep our balance of payments intact. So it's very interesting that, you know, we can criticize the Arabs for raising the cost of oil, but then the wheat was raised on them at the same time. The wheat was raised earlier. The wheat started going up in the spring of the year, and they didn't lose their head with the price increase in oil until the fall of the year. An interesting thing, too, when we talk in terms of embargo, they obviously have embargoed the United States on oil, some of the Arab countries, because they want to put pressure on us for political reasons. We embargoed soybeans last year. Now, soybeans is a very, very important crop to feed your animals, to bring about beef and the like. And so what we did is we were in short supply, and obviously we had contracts to supply soybeans abroad, but so our government just embargoed it, and none of it was exported, and the people who were counting on it abroad were just high and dry. So some people compare that to the embargo and say, well, you know, you're mad at us for what we're doing, and you do the same thing, and nobody gets too mad at you.
Surely wish a year ago I had had some dollars and some insight about the commodity market.
Well, no, you'd have been safer just buying gold.
Got it. That's true. It hit all-time highs again.
Yeah. But the only thing is, Larry, you probably didn't have any money, and I didn't have any money.
None at the time, none now. Just one quick thought on this before we take another question from Sonny. People are suggesting that the United States exercise more economic sanctions, like against Canada when prices of crude go up. Others say the U.S. shouldn't be vindictive. How do you feel?
Well, let's take the Canadian instance. The price, the world price of oil is $10 a barrel, okay? They were selling it, like everybody else was selling it to us last year, maybe $5 a barrel. Now, the Canadian government just put a tax on, starting February 1st, of $6.50 a barrel. Now, should the Canadians, in a free world market, if the Americans are willing to pay $5 a barrel, and if the French or the British are willing to pay $10 a barrel, should the Canadians be forced to sell us their oil cheaper than what they can sell it for? How would you feel, Larry, if somebody said, okay, we're going to make General Motors cars? Oh, well, let's take Alaska timber. We got some timber in Alaska. We got fisheries. People go out and fish. They collect fish. Supposing the world market for salmon is $5 a fish. Okay. Should we then be forced to sell it to the Japanese for $1 a fish or $2 a fish because of government fiat? Of course not. It's a free market situation, so we can get angry at foreigners for the price that they're charging us, but shame on us for letting them have such control over our market. And I'm sure we'll come to the emergency energy bill that's going to be voted on Tuesday, but you know, that's exactly what we're doing wrong.
Yeah, let the private sector seek its own level back and forth.
Well, I believe in a free enterprise system because it brings free choice to individuals. And I think the market can work in this area if we're permitted to work. But every time we've had government involvement with respect to this type of a free market situation, we've just given ourselves a whole pot of trouble.
You don't have a consistently liberal record, and I got to thinking of your ADA record, which came out, the Americans for Democratic Action gave you, 65 something?
Right, which I would consider moderate.
But I found this the other day, and it was garbled, so I doubt if it was used much in Alaska, because no one ever ungarbled it. And Sonny, are you listening on the phone or anything?
Yes, I'm listening.
The president of the Women's Lobby, Ms. Carol Burris, has notified Senator Mike Gravel, Democrat of Alaska. Her group has rated him 100% for his voting record in support of women's rights.
Well, I'm happy for you.
Yes. Feminist number one in Fairbanks is safe.
I've also done that well with the League of Women Voters, too, nationally. I've scored 100 on their criteria of votes.
Sonny, let's take the question, then we'll go to the phone.
Okay, the caller's question was, recently as last night, the Alaska Legal Services Group has requested funding from the Fairbanks Borough and Fairbanks City governments because they've lost some of their federal funding. The caller asked if you were familiar with this and could tell us how and why they lost their federal support.
I don't know precisely. It's not one of the committees that I serve on. I support very much the funding of legal services because I think it's so vital to bringing rights, real rights, to many of our deprived people. I would venture to say that it's probably part of the normal impacted withdrawal of funds that the administration has done as a matter of policy. The administration has tried to annihilate the legal service area ever since it's taken office, and this has been a continuous battle. I'm sure they will not succeed.
You're right, it was Title IV.
Right. And this is just Richard Nixon doesn't want to fund legal services. And so in the give and take of it all, a cutback occurs because there is a battle over it. I'm sure that if there's a change as time goes on here, we'll see this whole area rejuvenated.
There is legislation before the Congress now to, and I probably have this wrong, to establish a legal services, an independent legal services entity. And I would surely hope that that can somehow come to pass.
I would hope so, too. We've tried that same approach, you know, with the daycare centers because we couldn't get the administration to go on it. But that approach was vetoed, and I'm sure that Richard Nixon, if he was consistent, would probably veto this, even if we fought it through the Congress.
You know, I don't think you like him.
No, I didn't say that. All I'm saying is that there's a difference of opinions and a policy that should be exercised for the benefit of this country.
The senator could conceivably be the jury, Sonny. good evening, Beeline, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. Could I speak to Mike, please?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Yeah.
I can hear you.
Mike?
Yes.
Hello, Mike?
Yes, I can hear you. Please go ahead.
This is Gib Farenkamp.
Hi, Gib. How are you?
Yeah. I have two questions I'd like to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
One is, why did Stevens go against Alaska on this energy bill? Now, you don't have to answer that right at this present time. Another one is, why does the United States let the foreign countries test this great big airplane that you fought so hard to get in operation? But they can still come over in our country and test it, but we can't manufacture it here. Now, answer either one of them in perspective.
Okay, thank you, Gib, and I'll go ahead and hang up and answer that.
Now, Gib's first question, I'm going to preface just a little bit more. There are two things that we ought to comment on rather fully tonight, because they aren't altogether that well understood. One, there is emergency energy legislation before the Congress, which you object to, and which Senator Stevens does not. And then there is your omnibus energy bill, in which there is disagreement between you and Senator Stevens also, and your omnibus energy bill isn't that well understood by Alaskans yet. So let's go through this whole exercise.
Well, let's answer Gibbs' the second question first, then. I think it's just the ridiculousness of the situation, Gib, that we vote down the Concorde, the French manufacture it, and then need to do some cold weather testing, so they come up here and do their testing. I think it speaks for itself. I wish that we had gone ahead with the construction of an SST so as to maintain, one, our preeminence in the world of aviation, and two, so as to continue to improve upon what I think would be the quality of life. Let me go now to the next question. That is your statement about Senator Stevens and the emergency energy legislation. I don't know what his motivations are. I can only read the paper as you can, and he said that he was for this because of inflation. Now let him respond to his, or let him be accountable to the people of Alaska, as I am accountable. But I am very strongly opposed to the, and he was on the Commerce Committee and therefore was placed on the conference committee for this legislation which brought it about. I am very much opposed to the emergency energy bill. I was opposed to it in December, opposed to it in January, and opposed to it now. In December, had it passed with the special windfall tax provision that was involved, the government could have capriciously and arbitrarily confiscated any profit of any company at any point in time if it so desired, once a charge was made of price gouging by any one of the 200 million citizens in this country. And this would have been through the powers given the renegotiation board. We were able to kill that part of the bill by having almost every tax or revenue expert since Jack Kennedy's administration come before the Finance Committee and testify as to what a terrible bill this was. And so we were able to beat it in the Senate along with the environmentalists. recognize that if you're going to keep a standard environmental quality, you have to pay for that cost. So then it went back to conference, and it came back again. This time they took out the windfall profits tax, and so they tried to arbitrate and compromise, and they came back with, well, what we'll do is we'll roll back the price of oil. Now, that sounds awful good to the consumer. I mean, John Q. Public sits his TV set at night and listens to the news, and the reporter says, well, the people in Washington, led by Senator Scoop Jackson and other senators, they're going to fix it so you don't have to pay the terrible prices you're paying for oil, for gasoline. Like I say, it sounds very good, but let me give you an example of what happened last year. The government, the executive, decided they would give you cheap chicken. They said that they were going to roll back the price of chicken. They were going to freeze the price of chicken so it wouldn't go up. So what happened? They didn't freeze the cost of grain or the cost of anything else that went into the manufacturing. And so the poor farmer, who had a bunch of small chicks, found out that it cost him more to produce a chicken, a broiler, to sell, than it cost him more to feed that broiler and raise it to full size than he could sell it for. And so what did he do? He drowned the chicks. You saw it on TV. This was a whole national spread that was done about these farmers that were killing their chickens early because they couldn't afford to continue to stay in business. You can't ask people to go bankrupt. It's not good economics. And people obviously won't do it. So that was the example. So what happened? The government took the freeze off of chicken, and it leveled itself out. Now, we've got other inflationary problems, and I could speak to that separately. But I'll tell you one thing about the inflationary problem with oil. It started essentially this year, and it started as a result of Arab actions. And the only reason we got caught in it was because we became more and more dependent upon foreign oil. We consume 18 million barrels a day. Now, 7 million of that is foreign oil. We only produce 11 million. So if you roll back the price of oil to, let's say, $5, that means that that 11 million barrels that's produced in America will sell for $5. And then the oil that's sold that we import, that will come in at $10. Okay. Now, you and I have $1 million, Gib, and we're going to decide where we're going to invest that $1 million. Are we going to invest it drilling for oil in Alaska or in Texas or in Kansas and then get oil from our oil well and then sell it for $5? Or are we going to go to Indonesia? Or are we going to go to Saudi Arabia or the North Sea? Or are we going to go to Canada and drill the oil? Because when we do that, we find oil there, we can then sell it to the same Americans for $10. So what's going to happen is that nobody's going to drill for oil in this country. They're all going to drill abroad. And then what happens? We become more dependent upon foreign governments. And then when they decide, and of course that will create scarcity here in the United States, which will then drive up the international price of oil because we'll be bidding to get oil since we won't have any other country.